Bibles and turn to Psalm 101. That is Psalm 101. As we always do, we'll read the entire chapter. Follow along silently as we read Psalm 101. Psalm 101, the Bible reads, I will sing of mercy and judgment. Unto thee, O Lord, will I sing. I will behave myself wisely in a perfect way. O, when wilt thou come unto me? I will walk within my house with a perfect heart. I will set no wicked thing before mine eyes. I hate the work of them that turn aside. It shall not cleave to me. A froward heart shall depart from me. I will not know a wicked person. Whoso privily slandereth his neighbor, him will I cut off. Him that hath an high look and a proud heart will not I suffer. Mine eyes shall be upon the faithful of the land, that they may dwell with me. He that walketh in a perfect way, he shall serve me. He that worketh deceit shall not dwell within my house. He that telleth lies shall not tarry in my sight. I will early destroy all the wicked out of the land, that I may cut off all the wicked doers from the city of the Lord. Brother Alex, would you bless the service for us?
I don't think I need that. Sounds like we're working. So I think it was last Sunday, I was about to ask Pastor, you know, I had a sermon topic in mind, and I was going to ask him if I could preach, and then he actually comes up to me and says, hey, can you preach Sunday night? So I was like, okay. I was about to ask you that anyway. It's always nice. I always like preaching. You know, you really learn a lot yourself. When you do these things, you're actually now studying for a purpose. You have a goal. I really need a goal to be able to study. And so preaching gives me that clear goal. And I'm so grateful for Pastor for allowing us all to do this, have some fun. I'm sure everyone who's preached up here, it's been a pretty fun experience. You know, once you finish your sermon, you're not like procrastinating like me and doing it Saturday night. So, it's always fun and I get a little bit nervous, but yeah, it's like, thank Pastor. Let's open up a quick word of prayer. Lord, is in your spirit to preach your message and preach from your word and edify all the people here. In Jesus, I pray. Amen. So I was actually going to preach about slavery, more specifically chattel slavery that would be in the South. I didn't do that because I just ended up sounding like a deranged congregationalist. Who, if you don't know what the Massachusetts preachers, there are a lot of them congregationalists, a lot of Northern Baptists, and they were very radical in their approach. They were very anti-slavery. That's what split the Baptists between the Northern and Southern. And it wasn't really a lot, I couldn't really go about an hour into that because it is a very complicated topic. So I went with my secondary option, which was, something that's interested me. And before I get into it, I'll play a little game of, you know, can you guess what it is? Something happened on Wednesday. Anyone know what happened on Wednesday? It's an annual event, April 15th. Anyone? There you go, tax day. I don't know, I don't think it's a big deal, is it nowadays? You know, back in the day, it seems to be much more of a hassle, I guess, when everything is electronic and you can just do things online, submit online. It's a lot less, you know, compared to back then, you have paper W-2s and you actually had to do them. Now we have all these services like H&R Block, Jackson Hewitt, who do it for you, so it's a lot less hassle. But, you know, just thinking back to, there's a Season 9 Simpsons episode about what there's a mad scramble for tax day. That's April 5th, 1998, a week before I was born, interestingly enough. So apparently it was a big thing. But since it's tax day, but I think most people probably filed long ago. You know, you kind of look at your W-2 and it has all the deductions taken out of it already. Or if you're an independent contractor, you have to write a check. So everyone kind of starts thinking about taxes and, you know, taxes, of course, downstream from politics. They're kind of one and the same. And everyone kind of was wondering, that's a lot of money coming out of my paycheck. You start doing the math on that one. You're like, oh, this sucks. Life would be a lot better if I had that money I didn't have to give to Uncle Sam. You start grumbling, but I don't know. Taxes are, you have to pay them. I'm sorry. There are a lot of Christians who are tax protesters. That is wholly unbiblical. The Bible is pretty clear. You have to pay your taxes. You know, just as you have to pay your tithe, you have to pay your taxes. They're kind of going to different ministries. And so the title of my sermon is The Other Ministry. And that is what we'd call the state or temporal power, the government, the man. And, you know, just as you pay your tithe to the church, whatever you read, and actually read it, and it's kind of apropos, we read it in 1 Samuel 8 on Thursday, where Samuel warns the people of Israel about the king. And one of the things he warns about was, you're going to have to pay taxes to the king. I do not know what the political situation of the book of Judges was in turn, you know, in between all the judges. I imagine they probably had a local council of elders, you know, just go and look at what Moses had set up, but they didn't really have a centralized authority. And one of the things centralized authority does is you need ministers. Now you have things to manage. You know, you need, you know, no one likes bureaucrats. They kind of get a bad rep, but you kind of need them. You know, you're running a city. You have all this grain storage. Someone's got to do the Excel spreadsheet or the old tablet. If you didn't know, one of the oldest, some of the oldest writing in the world, there's the business complaint against Ian Nasir for shipping bad copper. There's a warehouse spreadsheet and a recipe for beer. And those are some of the oldest writing we have out there. So whatever complaint you have against, you know, work, it's not new. Better Business Bureau has been around for a long, long time. So is Excel. But, oh man, I got off track on that one. But this is something, you know, so tax protesters, unbiblical. Romans 13 is pretty clear that you just have to pay your taxes. A lot of people say, well, it's oppressive. You do have an argument. There are a lot of taxes. You still have to do it. I'm sorry. Like, as much as it sucks, I'd rather not pay sales tax, right? A lot of people in Washington would rather not. That's why Hayden Island exists. Why is there so a bunch of outlet stores right over the border? Why is IKEA right over the border? It's because Washingtonians do not like paying taxes on sales tax. But, so you can make the argument it's oppressive, but it's really not your call. Paying is still proper. And, just as the tithe, just as the tithe in 1 Corinthians 9:13, Paul says, do you not know that they which minister about holy things live off the things of the temple? Of course, this is talking about the Old Testament temple tithe. We had to pay 10% of what you earn or produce to the Levitical order, and this is what they live off of. And he's saying, well, now in the New Testament, this is for that same purpose, that the pastor lives off of, ideally would live off the tithe. I mean, this building is not free. We do have to pay rent. We do have to have power, you know, invites, all this kind of stuff costs money. And this is all, you know, all part of the church. And how does the church collect it? Is through the tithe and goodwill offerings. And then this, similar to that, is the state also collects it for the same purpose, to go about their work. And I'll get into what they do and how they do it. But in Romans 13, it says, 13:7, it says, render therefore all their dues, tribute to him, tribute is due, custom to him, custom. You know, tribute would be taxes. Custom is would be similar to if you have import fees like tariffs or excise taxes. That is what that is. And why is that? Is that, one, the church ministers the things of God, but not to neglect that the state also serves an important function for the Lord. And interestingly, in Mark 12:17, we have Christ, the Pharisees come up to try to trip him up on paying taxes, and he says, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. And it's really interesting, these things are, they're both phrased pretty much identically, and that they're separate, but they're almost, not equal, you know, of course God's supreme, I think, you know, when he's talking about things that are God, he's talking about like the temple tax. This is separate, but there are, you know, Christ doesn't say don't pay your taxes. He's saying, you know, this penny, this is a, you know, worldly thing. You have to pay it to Caesar. So of course this sermon is about the ministry of the Lord being the state. They are important. They're a thing. I'll get to why they're a thing. And why I was interested in this, well, you know, I grew up largely in the era of George Bush, and then Obama, and then Trump 1, and Biden, now Trump 2. And, you know, growing up, the president had this really, it's kind of lethargic, if I remember. I wasn't really into the news back then, but I don't really remember Obama doing a lot. It's kind of just, he did some things, and Bush was kind of just doing the whole Middle East thing. So, but now it's like I got really into it because we have a very active executive branch, which is very, you know, doing stuff, which is kind of crazy. So I got into it, and I was kind of contemplating. So we have this, you know, the Bible is talking about a lot about kings and how kings are kind of special. They are clearly the main characters of the whole story. A lot of times, from a narrative point of view, you know, of course Christ is the main character of the Bible, but you know, we have four books, the Books of Kings, the Books of Chronicles, where it follows the journey of kings and important people throughout the minor prophets. Kings play a very big role, such as in Daniel, you have Nebuchadnezzar, and then the Persian kings, Cyrus and Darius, and then through the building of the temple. They're ever present. They're very involved and very important. You have multiple parts in the Books of Psalms and Proverbs, where it gives special instructions to kings, especially in Proverbs, where I think it's in Proverbs where it talks about the heart of the king is in God's hands. You know, they're special, and well, we don't have a king, right? How does that correlate with our modern federal republic? So I was always wondering, like, what do we do? Like, we don't have a king, but kings are special. We have a federal republic. Is that less special? So this is why I'm preaching this is, I was curious, so, you know, maybe someone else's, maybe we'll answer your question. At the very least, hopefully you'll be at peace, not friends with the world, but like kind of at peace, if that makes sense, where you're not like struggling against things that, you know, are bigger than all of us, and just, you know, go about our lives sometimes. That's usually what we can do. Well, the first thing is, you know, why do we have a government? Can't we all just, you know, sing Kumbaya and get along? And the answer is no. They did that in Judges, and that didn't work out. They did that, you know, the Bible says in Genesis 6:5, and God saw the wickedness of man was great in earth, and every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Well, this is, of course, pre-flood, but, you know, not much has changed. You know, we're still man. We're still going to be evil. In Federalist 15, written by Publius, which is either Hamilton, Madison, or Jay, depending on which one. He says, why has government been instituted at all? Because the passions of man will not conform to the dictates of reason and justice without constraint. And in 51, he says, if man were angels, no government would be necessary. So this is something, obviously, government is a product of the fall. It's one of these things where because we're sinful in our nature, if we're just left to our own devices, it's going to be disaster, and everyone knows this, when you have anarchy, if you look at the early days of the Bolshevik Revolution, where you had effectively anarchy, people are just getting killed, and so you kind of need that strong government to make sure people are not just killing each other randomly for very little reason, or not defrauding each other, and that is why we have government. Also, if you look in the book of Genesis, as soon as the fall happens, people start building cities. As I said, you know, when you have cities, when you have organization, you need a leader. You need somebody to run it. You need bureaucrats to manage it. You know, think about your workplace. What would happen if everyone in your workplace was doing just stuff, right? You wouldn't make anything. You'd be spending your time just wondering what the other guy's doing. You need those, the leads, the supervisors to, you know, tell people what to do. They have the bigger picture. They're more detached. They can see it more, have more view. They can see the bigger picture, as I said. They can understand what's going on that you might not know. So I'm sure you've had that moment. You're at work. You get this a lot in blue collar, and it's like, well, what does my boss know? He told me to jump on this project. I was doing this, or you might have complaint, and he's like, he might be putting you there for a very good reason, because he might know that there's a bigger project coming up, right, that you don't know about. And that's government right there. Is sometimes they are aware of things before they happen that we might not be aware of. So let's say we have government because we're sinful. We need somebody to, tell us what is right and wrong, and that's what the church does. And then, when someone does wrong, you need the person with the sword to make sure judgment's carried out, and that's what the state does. I'll get to that my second point, but. So I didn't compile a list. So this question of what the king does is not new. Everyone's asked this since, forever. In the New Testament, we're in the New Testament, and we're also in a kind of a silent period in terms of Revelation. The Bible's complete. It's been complete for a while. And so a lot of the kings, that converted to, in name to Christianity, were kind of wondering, so we're now kings that are supposedly Christian. How do we form a kingdom? What do we do? And so they asked this, and of course our famous or more favorite king, James I, wrote quite a lot about the role of kings from a Christian perspective. He's not the only one. Quite a few people have written about this with the advent of Christianity being mainstream, so to say, in name only. I'm not going to, when I say Christianity, I guess there's little C Christianity, which would be broader, and then big C Christianity, which would be, saved people. But little C Christianity is now mainstream. So what does a king do? How does a king apply biblical law to rule his kingdom? And paper I highly recommend you all read is King James wrote. It's called The True Law of Free Monarchies. And he goes through and lists the duties of a king. And Brother Sean, a long time ago, I guess, preached a sermon about King James. And he mentioned King James actually knew the Bible, right? And I'd listened to this and it's like, well, I know the Bible. How much could he know? He actually knows the Bible. There's a difference between knowing the Bible and really knowing the Bible. He really knew the Bible. This is before the internet, and concordances could only go so far. So you actually had to read the Bible to be able to pull verses out. You can defend your doctrine using main verses, but can you go to tertiary verses to defend your doctrine? King James was able to do that. So you're there in Psalms 101. I did not copy down all my verses, so I'll have to turn there with you. Probably should have just put my ribbon in there since that is the one we're starting in. Just give myself a head start. So the first order, the first thing that kings do in this list, thank you, King James I, is minister justice and judgment to his people. He actually cites you read some of his papers and he'll cite his sources. You'll see a little footnote where he gives the verse or the chapter that's talking about. And in Psalms 101, this is a song of David of what he's doing, one of the greatest kings of the Old Testament. So if you model yourself after King David, minus a few things, you'll do fine. King James was famously monogamous. So yeah, he well understood of where to not follow David, unfortunately. Unfortunately for James and unfortunately for David. So this Psalms 101 is judgment. If you read the back half of it, David's talking about carrying out justice and judgment to his people, right? He that worketh deceit shall not dwell within my house, right? Judgment. He that telleth lies shall not tarry in my sight. He's judging people. He's carrying out justice. He that worketh, I will destroy all the wicked of the land, right? That's judgment. When King David's talking about, I will destroy all the wicked of the land, he's being literal. probably executing them, right? Yeah. That I may cut off all the wicked doers from the city of the Lord, right? This is the first thing that kings do, is they administer justice and judgment to people. They act as judge, jury, and often executioner. The other one is, you know, they said is to advance the good and punish the evil, also from Psalms 101, right? Part of justice and judgment is, you know, you're going to have court cases brought before you, right? And you're punishing the evil, and you're advancing by punishing the evil, you also advance the good. That's just how things work. You know, if you have a counterfeiter or something of that ilk, and you punish him, you know, that's good. Next one is to establish good laws to his people and procure obedience to the same. And as I said, he gives his sources. 2 Kings 18, verse 3, I added the 3 through 7. He just said 2 Kings 18. So if you don't know it, I think this is Hezekiah comes into power and lays down the law. And so 2 Kings. I don't really have any of the tabs, little color for tabs, or else I would have used those. But I forgot to get those on Friday when I went to Safeway, so we're doing another one. Right, Hezekiah comes into power, and what is one of the first things he does? Right, and he did what which was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that that David, his father, did. Right, next, right, establish laws and procure obedience the same. He removed the high places, break the image, cut down the groves, break in the pieces, the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days, children Israel did burn incense to it and called it Neshushtan. There we go. This is a example of the pattern you see in kind of the story of Kings, where the people kind of follow the kings. If you get that, if you pick up on that, when the king's good and the king's amazing, like Asa, Hezekiah, Josiah, the people kind of follow, right? And then when the king's wicked, the people kind of follow downhill, right? As I said, the king is really kind of the main character here. The people follow him. So one of them is establish good laws of the people. When you do that, you'll naturally kind of have the obedience of them. People inherently know what is good and what bad. The Bible says the laws of God are written on our heart. We may kind of try to ignore those, but it is a strong calling that people naturally try to do good, right? People may lie, but a lot of people know, even the secular world, lying is wrong, right? So the kind of people identify when someone is being good, like a king, and they'll follow him just naturally if he's doing these things. You kind of see this in the famous people of history, you know, like Julius Caesar, who I think is the thumbnail of the video. This is kind of representation. He's a populist, right? People knew about the corruption within the Senate of the day, and so they followed Caesar, who was really, he is dealing with a lot of senatorial corruption. You know, there's a lot of inflation those days, and Caesar was trying to bring it down, taking away senatorial held lands, giving it rewards to his soldiers who followed him through Gaul. And so people kind of identified that Caesar was, you know, a good guy. And so they naturally just followed him and listened to him. You see this in your workplace. So I just want to try to bring it down to, like, something we all see in your workplace. When your lead or your boss is really great and he's a trustworthy guy, like, I'm fortunate enough that my supervisor is a really great guy, really trustworthy and knowledgeable, they kind of exude this air of, like, you kind of tell yourself, like, oh, this guy's really great, I'm going to follow him. I'm going to do what he says, because I trust him. And that's what you see with the kings is, again, you get this picture of when the king's doing great, everyone's doing great, because everyone kind of knows that he's a special person. The next one is Psalm 72. You don't have to turn there. I'm kind of going all over the place right now. It's a list. But I suggest, like, you know, as I said, I didn't pick these ones. King James, when he was writing, he picked these ones. So he knew his Bible. He was able to argue points. He was able to point to, as I said, if you wanted to come up with a list of what kingly duties there are, would you have chosen Psalm 72? Right? And of course, this is a psalm, and I was reading it. It's kind of talking about Christ here. If you really, it's pretty obviously talking about a future Messiah. But if you want to be a good king, you know, psalms about the picture of Christ also apply to you. You know, Christ is the King of Kings, and if it's meant for the King of Kings, yeah, you can. It's pretty good advice. And then verse 7, in his days shall the righteous flourish, and abundance of peace so long as the moon endureth, right? It's kind of saying, like, if the king's great, this is all kind of stacks down. If the king's great, and the king's following all the laws of God and ministering justice, there'll be peace within the land. There'll be kind of this stability. Again, you saw that within King James's rule, where he's very strict. He's an absolute monarch, but he's a Christian king. And there wasn't a lot of, there wasn't any internal fighting. Compare that with his son, right? His son, Charles I, he had a lot of issues. He married a Roman Catholic, which is issue one. He was kind of, you know, if you believe some of the accusations, he was kind of a little corrupt. He spent a lot more money on the Navy. I think they're supporting the Dutch revolt against the Habsburgs in the Netherlands. And this was costing a lot of money. And, you know, he kind of searched for money where he shouldn't have. And so, you know, you watch the movie Cromwell, you get a pretty good idea of the whole, those whole events. But what happens, right? The king isn't great, and there's now a civil war, right? People do rise up. It's not right that people revolt and rise up. What the Puritans did, they shouldn't have done, they should have just gone to America. But the reality is we live in a fallen world, and sometimes these things happen. Even, you know, it's not a perfect world, but generally speaking, if you're a good king, if you're fair, you're just, you know, they'll still have their naysayers, but generally speaking, things are going to be very good compared to, like, some of the you know, the more wicked English kings. James II converted to Catholicism and was overthrown by Prince William and Queen Mary of the Netherlands. You know, that was a war. That was, a lot of people died in that. They didn't need to be, but what happened? The king was wicked, converted to Roman Catholicism. You know, they don't do that in England. And he's, or Mary, Queen of Scots, Roman Catholic, persecuted the new English church, killed a lot of people. Did not, that's, you know, killing innocent people isn't really considered advancing the good and punishing the evil, or justice and judgment. So what happened? She gets preach out of office and killed. Right. Well, the next thing that kings do is they decide controversies. This is part of administering justice and judgment. You don't have to turn here. He cites 1 Kings 3. This is the story of King Solomon deciding the matter of whose baby this was, right? It's really crazy. Just as a thought, I was like, well, what would happen if you're like that, the soldier in that room, right? And your king just says, well, let's just cut the baby in half. And you don't really know where he's going with this. You're like, why about to cut a baby in half? And then he's like, actually, whichever, if you don't know the story, two women come before Solomon and they both claim that the baby is theirs. And Solomon says, well, we're going to divide the baby. If you guys can't agree on this one. And then one of the women backs out and says, oh, we're not going to do that. And he says, you know, that is the true mother, because the true mother would not want harm to come to her baby, which is just, you know, how would you have come to that conclusion on that one? That is actually some really smart wisdom. Well, this is one thing that kings do, is they judge controversies and settle issues. Usually on the larger scale, if you look at Moses, once he appointed all the elders, they dealt with the day-to-day stuff, and Moses really dealt with the big, large stuff that would affect multiple large groups of people. And this is something a king will do, is, you know, he's not going to get involved in a dispute about who the fence being a foot over into someone's property. It's not what he does, but he will decide if it becomes an issue between two lords. Well, the next one is Romans 13, of course. Whenever a subject about absolute authority comes into play, Romans 13 is one of those ones. And James writes, to be minister of God for the wealth of them that do well, and as a minister of God to take vengeance upon them that do evil. Of course, this is one of the duties, is the executioner, right? sometimes people just have to die. And, you know, we don't want just everybody to take matters in their own hands. You get these back and forth killings. You think about the Hatfields and McCoys, where it's just this constant retaliation, or some of the gang violence in inner cities, where it's just a series of retaliatory attacks. You kind of sometimes you need this independent, disinterested party just to say, well, this person is just going to die, and matter is over, right? And of course, that's one of the duties of the king. Not literally. Kings usually have other people do it. There's a really great book called The Hangman's Diary. It's a 16th century diary written by the executioner, Franz Schmidt of Nuremberg, where his father was randomly chosen to be an executioner. They needed to kill somebody, you know, I think probably for murder or something, but nobody actually wanted to do it, right? If you're killing somebody for the right reason, you still are now a murderer. You know, not in the sense that it's innocent blood, but you've still taken life. And in medieval times, you were treated differently, right? Everyone knew that you were required for society, but no one wanted to be with you. It's like if you ever talk to like garbage truck workers or like wastewater plant people, it's a dirty job, nobody wants it, but everybody knows somebody has to do it, right? You know, just make sure you shower before you come over the barbecue, I guess. And so this is something the king does, is appoints people, usually to carry out God's wrath, right? A lot of the verses in the Old Testament, you know, carry on sentences. And of course, they have to be enforced, right? What's the point of law if it's just stated? There needs to be bite to the law. And this is something also, he actually cites, I was going through it in the text document I had, it had little hyperlinks when the verses come up. And the next one is, as a good pastor to go out and in before his people. You never guess what he cited. He cited 1 Samuel chapter 8. This is something we read it on Thursday. This is something the people demanded, was somebody to speak for them. And actually, let's just turn there. If you guys didn't memorize it, I still have it even ribboned. Look at that. Let's see. Yep, verse 20. That our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. He's not literally saying to fight battles, but be the leader, be the pastor. Not necessarily the pastor of a church, although as king of England at that time, he did take a more direct role in the Anglican church. If you didn't know, the Anglican church has the king of England as their pope, kind of. He's usually more distant than the actual pope for the Catholic Church, but technically that is how they're structured. And so he took a very active role compared to a lot of other English kings. But he's more of talking about a pastor as more of like as a shepherd, where he viewed the people of England as his flock, and he viewed himself more as a father figure to the people of England. And another one, the last one that he gave a list is, through the prince's prosperity that people's peace may be persecuted. He cited Jeremiah 29. I read Jeremiah 29 a few times. I actually couldn't get what he's trying to say here. Jeremiah, it's a letter to the people of captivity. And you can read it on your own time. I think he's talking about verse 7 is what I came down to. I do not know what he's talking about here, but nevertheless, this is a great, great verse, or great point that I bring up, is that through the prince's prosperity, the people's peace may be procured. This is one of the benefits of having a king or a supreme king, like an emperor, is they're not in the grind, so to say, right? They have the money. They have all the money, right? In theory, they own all the land. So they don't really need to overburden people. You see that with when the children of Israel rebuilding the temple, And they have the naysayers come up before, I think it's Cyrus. And Cyrus is actually like, they're like, oh, you know, if they build a temple, they're going to stop paying their tithes. And they're going to start like not sending you the tribute. And, you know, he's king over one of the most powerful empires at the time. Persia was huge, right? And he says, well, who cares? Like, yeah, well, it's like a decimal point, like a fraction of my wealth. Yeah, let's just send, actually, you're going to send your tithes over there, right? How about that? If you want to like step up to me, you're going to get hit. And kings, by nature of being like supreme, have that ability, right? You know, to be more generous, right? They don't have to consider money, you know, money. If you think about the super rich, of course, the super rich nowadays are just kind of wicked and greedy, but you know, in theory, like the kings who are just like super wealthy, like, you know, money's not a concern to me. Like, yeah, we're just going to build some churches now. And it's just done, right? They don't have to worry about the budget. It's just, we're now doing this. My word is we're building a church here. And so those are the duties of the king. So just to recap so far, we have a government because we're wicked and we can't manage ourselves. Therefore, we have a king and his ministers to manage it for us, right? And so why a king? Well, the next question is, you know, why a king? There's a lot of forms of government out there, right? We have a federal republic headed up by a president. That's our official form of government. We've had a king in the past. Our last king, King George, was actually insane. If you read the reports of his later life, they don't know what was wrong with him. They think it might have been bipolarism, but they just didn't really know that back then, so it was never written down. Well, so why a king? Well, just plain, kings mentioned all over the place. There's no mention of, you know, democracy anywhere. And, you know, one of the examples of democracy is the Jews voting to kill Jesus. So there's your example of democracy. Or in Daniel chapter 6, when all the, you know, all the representatives conspire to try to get Daniel killed by coming up with the order that if anyone prays to anyone that isn't the king of Persia, that would be put to death. Right? These are the examples of democracy and republics in the Bible. It's like not a great track record. I'm not saying the kings don't have some bad examples, but you know, kings are pictured in a good light, even otherwise, like heathenish kings like Nebuchadnezzar in chapters 1 through 3. Well, this is actually there's another good book. Actually, I have it up here. It's called De Monarchia. It's written by D. Dante. He did political stuff as well. And one of the issues that he was facing, some context, is during the early Renaissance period, the Catholic Church was trying to expand into temporal politics and kind of overasserting itself, and which angered a lot of local princes who couldn't stand up to this. And so Dante kind of flippantly was writing, like, actually, he's kind of wrote a whole political book about what the king does. And then the second part of the book is, now that we've established what a king is, here's why the Roman Church should not get involved in politics. And he actually does a really good job. It's a really interesting book, but he writes, therefore mankind is most like God when it is ruled by one ruler and consequently most in harmony with God's intention. And this is what it means to be in good, indeed ideal state, as we established at the beginning of this chapter. Well, what is he talking about? In the Bible, it says that man is made in the image of God, right? In a sense, not just in kind of physical proportions or appearances. Of course, the Bible talks about God having, you know, identifiably human physical traits, like, you know, Moses sees the back of God, you know, God's hand, right? These things, or no man has seen the Father, but, you know, we've seen the Son, and the Bible says that Jesus is an express image of his Father. It's not just talking about the physical nature, but also the image more of like a mindset. Of course, I go back to the Bible saying that the laws of God are written on our hearts, right? And just by nature, he goes through the book and saying, like, we by nature just accidentally do these things that mimic God, right? If you think about, you know, the Trinity, we believe that God the Father has the supreme will, and that Jesus being perfect follows that will, that Holy Spirit being perfect follow that will. But the Bible also says that Jesus has his own will. you know, but he follows the Father perfectly. And this is something that that he's trying to tie to monarchy is, well, God rules with one will. Therefore, if we mimic that and re-rule, do everything with one will, we'll be better. We might say that in the household, right? I talked to pastor about this, and he said this before, you know, any beast with two heads is a freak, right? He said in the household, right, if you have, you know, the husband and wife kind of co-ruling, it's chaos, right? You need one supreme will to kind of say, this is how we're doing things. There's no argument about it. Not saying that this has to be absolute, like, I mean, kind of have to listen, might have a point, but you kind of need that. Then you can have ministers as king, right? And advisors, good idea, but you still need, like, we're doing this now. And that's one advantage of having one a supreme king, is he could just say, well, we're doing this now, no ifs, ands, and buts, or in a company, right? If you have a really good CEO, and his will is like, we're going to do these things now, you know, he'll make decisions that may not seem, you know, economical, right? He might take a loss one year and invest a lot into factories and workers, or pay workers more. Henry Ford was famous for this. He took all the workers and like triple. They're having problems with turnover, and so his solution to turnover was just triple everyone's salary, right? And it worked. Now everybody is flocking to Ford factories to work. They want to be there. Now turnover is non-existent. No one doesn't want to work at Ford, right? Now you don't have to retrain people. But economically, if you were to do this all of a sudden, it wouldn't make sense, especially if you think about a company that has a board of representatives, they might never do this. They're not going to think about that because it's going to cost money, right? And they can't really picture just some intangible future of like, actually in the future, this is going to make us more money and be cheaper. They're not going to see that. But if you have one really smart guy who's willing to go out and make these decisions, it makes sense. We're actually seeing this nowadays with our real estate loans, where banks are just, since all the banks are kind of like spread out, they all want to do real estate because it's something that's assured. Like people are going to buy land, and it's kind of low risk for them. People are always going to want to buy houses and always going to need loans. And it's just kind of like, well, yeah, it's just always going to make money. But in times past, this is something that the Second Reich did. That's the German Empire post 1870 to 1918, is they had a central bank, right? A supreme central bank who was able to make decisions that don't make sense in the now for the future. They'll say, well, we're actually now going to, instead of issuing loans to real estate, we don't need that. We're going to issue loans for factories. We're going to issue loans, we're going to pay for roads and factories, stuff. And not going to how do you quantify how much value a highway generates, right? How do you quantify, if you were to build I-5 nowadays, how do you say how much is this going to generate? It's kind of an intangible amount of money, but hopefully everyone knows that having I-5 cutting through from Southern California to Seattle and beyond is very important for trade. Think how many trucks go on that, right? But you can't put that in, how do you put that into numbers? It's very hard. But having a king who's able to say, we're going to build factories, we're going to build roads, we're going to invest in the future, makes sense. Of course, something brought up the senatorial corruption in the late Roman Republic. We have all these voices, they're all kind of trying to get their own grind going. They wanted to own little side hustles, so to say. They're out there for themselves, and it's kind of just confusion, corruption, people being cheated. Their solution to the labor problem was import slaves. And so at one point, like, I think it's like a third of the Roman population was slaves during the time of Caesar, and no one likes that. You know, everyone knows that, like, competing with free labor doesn't work. And so that's what happens when you get one of the problems with democracies and republics is you have multiple interests, right? Again, you go back to having a king or emperor who's just has everything, he owns everything. You know, he doesn't need anything more, right? He's never going to go starving. He's always going to be fed. He doesn't have to worry about these things. He's able to make these hard decisions. You know, something about like bribes and stuff. If you have like a small judge, in a small town, you might be able to bribe him more, right? But if you have, like, the supreme judge who does everything like a king, you know, you can't bribe a king. You can just take your stuff, right? You don't, he doesn't need that money. What are you going to do? Not to say that kings in past haven't been bribed. They have. George III, our last king, was kind of an absent king. He let Parliament run riot over him, kind of let the EIC do some things to us, and that's one of the reasons we ditched them. But so not to say that kings are free from corruption. They are, at the end of the day, still men. So we have a king. Well, we don't have a king, but just to kind of keep recapping the points, we need a government because we're sinful and we're fallen. The king has the set rules to follow biblically. If you go through the book, it's pretty nice. King James had a pretty good list. Kings are ideal because not only do they mimic what God is having, you know, being one, but, you know, they're able to make these hard decisions. And so my next, this is kind of like a journey through my thought process is, well, so we don't have a king. We have a representative republic or a federal republic. How does that work, right? Some people, I don't want to like say vague booking, but I've seen it over like my 10-year course of being like online, so to say, is you see this a lot of people who are rebellious say, well, the Bible only talks about kings. We don't have a king, ergo, I don't have to follow the government. And that's just not true. Obviously, you kind of the spirit of the law is, you know, kings or rulers, you know, people who rule over you. So how would a federal republic like ours fit into all this? Well, I think I was talking to the pastor about this. I just on Thursday afterwards, because we're talking about, you know, we just had a sermon about kings. There was a little bit portion of a Thursday night sermon, and you know, my thought process was, well, a federal republic. If you really think about how our government, we've just split up all the offices of the king and dished them out to three parties. We, of course, have the, if you don't know, and federally, we have the judicial branch, which is the Supreme Court and all the different federal circuit courts around. We have the legislative branch, which is the Congress, the House of Representatives, the Senate. They write the laws. And then, of course, you have the executive branch. And, of course, these are all just duties of the king split up. And so republics, it's just a roundabout way of just having a king without having a king. And just having a king would just make it simpler. And this is something that the Romans knew, right? They're famous for having a republic. Everyone knows about the Roman Republic. We modeled our government off of theirs, kind of. But everyone knows that in times of distress, they would do away with the republic and just appoint a dictator, right? It's okay, this like this whole democracy thing, kind of cool, right? Allows the senatorial class to make a lot of money. But when the enemy's at the gates, we just need some guy to just tell us what to do. Like, so again, this is kind of like republic. It's just a runaround for not having a king for various means. But if my opinion on republics is if they can accomplish all the different duties of a king, then they effectively just are one. And so we still have to, even though we don't have a king, we should still obey a republic as if they were one, if they act like one. As I said, one of the issues with republics is the corruption. The Bible says in Mark 3:24, everyone knows it. My Bible verse is on two different pages. And if a kingdom be divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And that's really where you see republics fall, is you have all these different warring factions and they can't get along. You see this a lot with European politics, if anyone's interested in that. We have the parliamentarian systems where all these different factions have to form a united government and have a majority. And if they can't do that, there is no government. And they shut down and it just doesn't happen. I think it happened with Germany just recently because the AfD gained a large majority. And no one wanted to be with them. Now, the AfD is like their right wing, but I think it's led by a lesbian and a Muslim. I think. So I don't know what kind of right wing they're doing, but I think if you actually line it up, they come about in to like 90s Democrats is where they actually land on a political spectrum. But no one wanted to be with them. Germany just doesn't like right-wing anything. Wonder why. Let's see. So, should we, like, obeying the government is a big thing. And the issue of legitimacy is brought up, right? We did not have a great falling out with the British government during the Revolutionary War. It's called the war, right? War is what happens when politics and kind of negotiations fail. The reason for this is, as I said, King George III was actually mentally insane. For some, like, you read later in his life and they just find him, like, running around in his nightgown in a tree. His parliament, unelected officials, and the East India Company, they're the big trade company, were trying to use the colonies in America to offset their business losses. I think they had lost a lot of money in India, and so they're trying to use us to recoup their losses. That's why you have the Boston Harbor. We liked tea, right? We bought tea from the East India Company. The problem was, is they said, actually, now you have to buy our tea, and then you have to pay taxes to us on our tea, right? So kind of double dipping on that. And that's what was happening, and we didn't like it because, you know, we were English citizens, right? We owed allegiance to the king by the charters, which were through the king, not to parliament. And so we're kind of you have the saying, no taxation without representation. We didn't have representation in parliament, right? And so we're kind of like, hey, we were begging King George, like, dude, you got to do something. Like, stuff is happening and over here, and it's not great. We're about to be like all slaves to the East India Company, a factory. You think about like the factory store where you just kind of always in debt. That was about to happen to us. And he just didn't want anything to do with it. Was let parliament, so we just said we're out if we're gonna be there. But it's still a kind of rebellion against the king. However, and so a lot of people say, well, that was illegitimate, but we did win. In 1783, we won. And then in 1814, during the War of 1812, we also won against the British. So obviously, if you're to believe in like divine providence and God and like trial by combat, we won. So obviously something was legitimate, or we'd end up like the traitor at South, who they ceded from the federal government, and they were crushed in less than 4 years. And that's what happened. That's what rebellion against a power looks like, is you get crushed by the legitimate power. And so, excuses of why we shouldn't follow government really come down from rebellious people who just don't want to follow government. Some people are kind of more educational and they want to kind of question authority as like this, I think the Socraterial method where you just ask questions to gain understanding. Most people who, like you think about these libertarian types, they just want to do their own thing. They don't want to be told. They never really grew up. And they just don't want to follow authority. So everything that they don't like is just illegitimate. Some people bring up that, you know, the saying, no king but Christ, as, you know, like, oh, we shouldn't have a king but Christ or king. I don't really see how, one, a human can threaten a title of God. And also, one of the titles of Christ is King of Kings, Lord of Lords. So that would presuppose that there are kings and of lords to be king and lord of. So, one of the other ones I've heard is, a slight twisting of Acts 5:29. If you turn there, this is we ought to obey God rather than man. And it's actually really interesting if you read that, because it has a parallel. Later in Acts, I'll go there. There's kind of a parallel situation that happens. Acts 5:29. Of course, this is, Peter. Yeah, this is Peter and one other of the apostles. They get arrested. It's the whole passage starts in verse 17. And the high priest rose up, and all that were with him, the Sadducees, were filled with indignation, and they laid their hands on the apostles and put them in common prison. So who's doing the arresting? It's the Sadducees, right? Of the two sects, the Pharisees and the Sadducees were the more wicked ones. I don't think a Sadducee ever gets saved in the Bible, but you see some Pharisees do. Paul, Pharisee. Yeah. Gamaliel, you know, he's also a Pharisee, but he does speak, later in this chapter, he does speak some truth. Nicodemus, Pharisee, right? You see the interactions of Pharisees where Jesus just roasts them, but the Pharisees a little bit more understanding. But again, who's doing the arresting? It's the Sadducees, the high priests. Were they the lawful authority in the land? No, the Romans were. And they put them in common prison. And then the prison doors open that night, right? And the disciples leave. Did they break any laws to end up in prison in the first place? Any Roman laws? No, they never broke a Roman law. Therefore, they're innocent men. And they could just go out of prison. And then later on, what I assume is the militia, the Romans used the militia a lot, kind of these local guys as police officers, and they drag him back to the council, and you get the council, again, not the Roman court system. These are just high priests. And they say, hey, did we tell you not to, we told you not to do this thing? And of course, Peter, fires back, we ought to obey God rather than men, right? And he goes on this whole thing, really great. And then Gamaliel, as I said, just, he spits some truth out, right? He makes a great point, and they let him go, right? So the whole situation is, well, one, they had no authority to make the arrest in the first place. Two, they had no authority to charge him. And again, they lacked any authority, right? These are Sadducees and Pharisees. The Levitical order that they stood for is dead. It's gone. These are just a bunch of posers in the temple, right? It'd be like in the modern equivalent of the apartment complex leader, right? Coming up and say, hey, you can't knock doors of our tenants. And it's like, well, what authority do you speak of? Because the Supreme Court says I can. Right. You know, that's higher authority. That's an actual legal document. The Constitution says I can. Yep. And you are, right, you're a worker here, like the maintenance guy. It's like, dude, who are you? Like, the same thing. It's like, they're just men, right? They have no authority whatsoever, right? So they didn't break any Roman laws, so they weren't actually, they're innocent men. They're free to go at the end of it. Of course, the next time prison's brought up in the book of Acts is the story of the Philippian jailer, right? Paul and Silas, unlike in earlier on, they were actually charged with breaking Roman law. I don't know exactly what Roman law they break, but they were accused of it. And in verse 16, if you couldn't guess. Verse 21 says, and teach custom which is not lawful for us to receive, neither to observe being Romans. I guess there must have been a law against it, but they were put in prison. And similarly, they had a chance to escape, right? Everyone knows the story. I think it's an earthquake. And earthquakes and everyone's doors open and all this stuff breaks and they're still there, right? And, you know, the prison, the warden comes by, he's all freaking out and he's about to kill himself. And everyone knows the story. Paul's like, oh, we're still here, right? And later on, you know, then they have the whole story of the jailer getting converted. But at no point did they leave. They still obeyed the Roman government. They could have probably left, right? The jailer probably would have let them leave the prison at this point. They're probably good friends, but they stayed in prison. And later on, how they get their captivity is they say, well, actually, we're Roman citizens. And all the other guys are like, okay, we can't like beat you. We can't do anything. I think this happens later on where Paul's about to be beat and he says, well, actually, we're Roman citizens. So just contrast between the two is, you know, Peter and I already forgot the other apostle, they were under no obligation to obey some bunch of posers and of a dead religious order. And they didn't. But Paul did obey the Romans. He does it multiple times. He has no issue. Peter, would later, of course, write 1st and 2nd Peter, which have a lot of verses about obeying powers, right? And this wasn't I don't think he had a like one of the physical Peter moments, I guess, where he just didn't get it. I think he was right in both situations. So that's, you know, they obeyed. Even Christ obeyed the Roman law, going before Pilate. He just says, like, look, I gave you this, basically, you were given this power, and they still obeyed it. Right? One of the points that Dante brings up to kind of prove that the empire is supreme to the church is, he says, well, the empires existed before the church did, and Christ obeyed the Roman Empire in all points, right? You know, he chose, of all the times he could choose to be born, it's during a Roman-mandated census. He comes into being at the order of Augustus indirectly. He obeys all Roman laws, right? You see this with the story of, like, when they try to get him on something, when they try to get him on the coin, he's like, actually, he comes out with no. Or if the women caught in adultery, right? Jews weren't allowed to kill people according to their law. And he gives an out that he's blameless before the state. And so, you know, hopefully the points of this part are, you know, we have kings because we're, holy moly, I really went over. Oh, man. So I checked the time. I'll kind of wrap it through the next point. I went a lot longer on that one than I intended to. So we have a king because we're sinful. There's a set rules for kings on how they should act, how they should be in the Bible. If they follow the Bible, they'll be great. They don't necessarily, I want to say this, they don't necessarily have to be saved to be a good king. It helps, but you've seen a lot of heathen kings. Next point is the church and state. I'll just try to rapid fire through this one, since I went way, way farther on my first point. I guess I really was brought up after Pastor Thompson getting to the second point 50 minutes into the sermon. The next one is the church and state and separation thereof. In English, in America, we have this concept of the separation of church and state, which is usually misused to push that the state must be some atheistic secular organization, where the clear intention goes back to when large portions of the colonies were effectively had an official state religion, or the Anglicans. If you didn't know, the word anti-disestablishmentarianism comes from the disestablishment of the church states of Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Connecticut, which were congregationally run. They actually had a church state. And there's a really great paper written by Isaac Bacchus called Appeal to the Public for Religious Liberty. And he's a Baptist minister, and he goes through why we should have the First Amendment. If you didn't know, the First Amendment was pushed by Baptists, who were persecuted for not baptizing babies usually. That was the big one, by Americans. And he goes through and says, actually, this is unbiblical. Also goes through separation of church and state is that religious leaders should not hold secular office. Historically, like the Lollards would write that the charge against bishops or pastors that hold secular office was they just call them hermaphrodites. So if you've seen an old document, like I think Thomas Jefferson called John Adams a hermaphrodite, wasn't literally, it's because he's holding two offices. That's just how they told it. Of course, you have the Jesus telling Pilate, you know, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would fight that I should not be delivered to Jews. You're right. He's saying, look, my kingdom, the kingdom of God, is not of this world. It's not a physical thing. It's not a threat to any established order. It's next. We haven't hit the kingdom of God yet, right? That's later. So then how can the church dictate the state, right? The church has a separate thing going than the state. I think everything would be better if the people in charge were nominally Christian, right? Little c Christian. The closer the better, I guess Baptists have historically just made terrible politicians. We've had four Baptist presidents, Harding, Truman, Carter, and Clinton. If you're a Baptist and you had your heart set on being a president for whatever reason, not looking good. There's a lot of Presbyterians that are right about a lot of things of the Bible. Episcopalians have had a lot of presidents who are not pretty good, right? Because you don't have to be saved to be a good person. It helps, not required. Isaac Bacchus would write that the church is armed with light and truth to pull down the strongholds of iniquity and to gain souls to Christ and into this church to be governed by his rules therein and again to exclude from such their communion. Who will not be so governed while the state was armed with the sword to guard the peace and the civil rights of all persons in society to punish those who violate the same? So he's saying, like, look, the state has its mission, the church has its mission, completely different. If you know, like, the great commandment in Mark 16, I'll just read it. You know, go ye all in the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He that believeth and baptized shall be saved, and he that believeth not shall be damned. And these signs shall follow them that believe. In my name shall they cast out devils, and they shall speak with new tongues, and shall take up serpents. And if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them. Right? You know, this is the great commandment given to the churches. It doesn't say anything about the church running government. That's not our job. Right? Bacchus writes that, I don't have it in here, but, you know, he writes that there's such mischief that pen cannot ever tell when this happens, right? And what happened? Usually, people, right, just people are being killed or persecuted, you know, being beaten. The Baptists were famously beaten in Virginia, which caused James Madison to be more religious, like, tolerant, wanting religious freedoms. Not to say that, you know, the government can't get involved in certain, you know, things such as the Mormons and Romanists who are, you know, threaten the fabric of society. The Mormons were famous for just extrajudicial killings in the early days. That's why they're way out there. That's why there's an army base. And there used to be an army base in Salt Lake City because Mormons would just kill people. So that's why the government got involved, right? That's a just thing, right? But government wasn't involved in for their weird doctrines. It was mostly just because they're killing random people. The papists, who are foreign power coming in to influence us, that's when the government gets involved. But, you know, we have our own battle, like stuff like the Episcopalians. I don't think the government should, like, oppress the Episcopalians, even though they're, like, literally gay in a lot of cases. That's a spiritual battle. That spiritual warfare that's for the church to expose and pull down. You know, it's bad precedent if we give the government power to do these things. Because, yeah, it's great. Yeah, what if we have, like, a fundamental Baptist, like, executive branch? That'd be really cool. But it's dangerous precedent. It's rather just everyone just, the government just not be involved in this at all. Not to say that government should be completely secular, because, as I said, right, government wields a sword, but the church wields a torch, or the flashlight nowadays. And so, you know, how can the government judge if all the judges don't know what's right and wrong? So definitely, you know, having, you know, nominally Christians who know their Bible in government is, of course, great. But as for, like, enforcing that, you know, Baptists have historically not done this. You can't compel. Another one is Christian liberty. You cannot compel people to believe, right? We'd have probably really great soul-winning numbers if we could just compel people to be saved. We'd also probably be arrested because I don't know how you're going to compel someone to do something, but probably not legal, whatever way you're going to do it. So we can't compel people to be saved or not, so how can we compel beliefs legally, right? People have to come to the truth on their own, and again, it's the church's job to do that. Again, like, you know, if it's unlawful for bring a civil suit against believers, then, like, how much more unlawful would it be for the government, like, you involve the government in this, in these kind of things? A little bit of time. My last one is, like, so how should we interact with the state? As a person, as a church, we should be separate. Obviously, if someone here was running for political office, and there was a Baptist in Connecticut, Jane McCormick, who's running for political office there, you definitely shouldn't be, like, it'd be, like, wicked to excommunicate him for that. If someone's running for office in our church, probably that's just a job, right? That's his prerogative. So church should stay out of this kind of thing. Government should stay out of dictating what beliefs are lawful or not, if it doesn't threaten, you know, the peace of the people. Well, so how should the people interact with the really quickly, how should you interact with the state? It's kind of just up to you on how much the Bible gives guidelines, right? It doesn't, you cannot compel, like, you can't be compelled to, like, go vote or something. That's up to you if you want to do it. But there's certain guidelines, like, you know, we're told not to curse the king in Proverbs 20, verse 2. It says, if you curse the king, that's wicked. Proverbs 20, verse 2 is not to provoke the king. Ecclesiastes 10, 20 is not to curse the king. And 2 Peter 2 is to honor the king. I think it's actually 1 Peter chapter 2 is where it says, honor the, fear God, honor the king. In 2 Peter, we have the false, you can turn there if you want. I have it mostly written down. 2 Peter, it describes reprobates. It says, but chiefly them that walk after the flesh and the lust of the uncleanness and despise government, presumptuous are they, self-willed, they are not afraid to speak evil of dignitaries, right? This is talking about reprobates in this whole thing, right? These, obviously, right? So, you know, speaking evil of dignitaries, disobeying government, and bringing railing accusations is not the way to treat authority, right? Online, you know, I'm probably not normally involved, but in online drama and stuff, you know, not church drama, but just general online stuff, the accusation of pedophilia gets thrown around everywhere. Actually, one of the podcasters I listen to, he says you should treat the pedophilia accusation, we would say reprobate, as a loaded gun, right? If you call someone a reprobate, you are saying they should be put to death. That is a serious thing, right? If you're not willing to do that yourself, you shouldn't call someone a reprobate. That is, if you're wrong, that's railing accusation. If you're right, then yeah, go for it. You know, if you know you're right on something, you know, fire off in precatory prayer every now and then. But if you don't know it, you know, and you call someone a reprobate, that's, you know, I think would be fall under per se defamation case. I know pedophilia, if you call someone a pedophile and they're not, that is per se defamation. They will win they'll just win court cases that way. So you better be sure of an accusation, not just, you know, fire from the hip, call someone something. You know, someone like, if you call, you know, Scott Bessent a reprobate, he is, he's gay. He's openly gay. He's our Secretary of the Treasury, I think, right now, right? It's on Wikipedia. He's married to a dude. Like, yeah, he's a reprobate. Shouldn't be anywhere in office. He is actually an okay Secretary of the Treasury. But if you read what he did, other stuff he did, I think he worked for Soros before. So pick one, and you could probably disqualify him on both. But yeah, definitely don't rail against stuff. Don't rail against leaders. You know, I joined Facebook for Marketplace. Of course, everyone, it starts recommending you kind of people in your circles. And somehow I got thrown into like the libertarian Christian circle. And they're just like, you have those people firing off from the hip, railing accusations against politicians with no proof, just saying these things. And that's wicked. The Ecclesiastes 10:20 says, curse not the king in the heart, for a little bird will carry it through the air, right? You know, if you go on Twitter, that little bird is Twitter. It used to be their thing. But it's pretty easy to not get the police involved in things. If you haven't noticed, when we go out soul winning, that's usually the only time you interact with police and the spirit and like doing the church mission, and they usually just don't show up by themselves. Someone has to call them there, right? There's no police patrols, and usually they just don't do anything, right? They get there too late. I've only seen the police like kick us out of a facility once, and there's some townhouses over there, and they actually had some actually legal backing to do that for some reason. But usually, if you be a normal person in society, you'll do fine, right? You don't have to worry about these things. You can say during the events of Revelation, we'll probably have more friction with the government. That's not right now. If just today, if you don't speed going home, you're probably not going to talk to a highway trooper, right? If you just be normal, police they have bigger problems than to harass random people. Sometimes they do. That's a problem. But generally speaking, usually when you interact, every time I've interacted with a police officer in a negative manner, I was doing something wrong that I shouldn't have. You know, I think they're wrong in both situations. Actually, one of them got a ticket out. One of them, I probably could have fought it in one, but I still broke the law. Generally, yeah, just be normal. It's pretty easy, actually. Think about it. Not that difficult. Not to be a weird freak. So, there's not many laws that you have to follow that will get it. Just in conclusion, in Romans 12:18 says, is to live peaceably among all men, you know, within reason. That's something we should try to strive to do. Not be like James 2. Or I think James talks about not to be friends with the world that's enemy to God. I mean, kind of like work friends. Like, you have your coworkers, and you're kind of friendly with your coworkers, hopefully. It just makes life easier, right? If you just piss off all your coworkers, work's not going to be that great. No one's going to like you. But if you're kind of like work friends, where it's like, you know, my work friends will talk about, like, you know, sinful behavior that they do, and I don't have to agree with it, I don't have to be there, I can just walk away, and they know my opinions. I have the title of Division 1 Hater at Work, because I've shared my opinions about what they do too many times, but I'm still friendly with them, just because I'm at peace. I know I can give my opinions, but it's, again, they do have liberty to choose to not to listen, and that's kind of, I think, what our goal should be with, you know, these higher powers, is kind of understand what they're about. You know, politics is very important. It affects all of us, what happens. You know, we shouldn't be, like, too embedded in it, because that causes problems. Unless you really want to be, that's up to you. Just know it's a dirty job. It's a dirty business. And not everyone's built to handle that, you know. But we should not be, like, just weird, isolated weirdos. They're just disconnected, because that's how you get a cult. So yeah, as well, so I think it says be in the world, not of the world, right? You know, you're gonna have to go to work and talk to people who are unsaved, and, you know, adulterers, fornicators, drunkards. You have to talk to these people during your everyday life, but you shouldn't be friends with them. Yeah, I think that's about it. Just two books, some books that you should probably read, is Appeal to the Public for Religious Liberty by Isaac Bacchus. It's a PDF. It's online. It's from 1783. It's a great source where he gives a lot of Bible verses for what he's a Baptist. And he gives a lot of Bible sources for the separation of church and state. It's pretty important to know that's a Baptist distinctive. We've always kind of believed that. And then King James has a lot of writings. True Law, Free Monarchy, great reading. I was reading from that. Basilica Doran, you know, great reading. His 69 Speech to Parliament, great reading. He knows what he's doing. I suggest you read it. Just give you a little bit of perspective on, you know, civil, kind of like Christian kingdoms, like not like a theocracy, but Christian kings. The other one is Dante Alighieri. He's not a Christian, but he's like nominally Catholic, culturally Catholic. But he gives a lot of, you know, he still uses the Bible to kind of explain what the duties of kings are and why the church, the Catholic Church, should not be involved with that. I put that as like a little bit more comical. He makes some really great points about it, but I definitely recommend you read James, King James's writing, and Isaac Bacchus. With that, a little bit over, I'll close in a word of prayer. Lord, thank you for helping me preach your message. So I ask you a blessing to edify today, and a blessing to singing to you. In Jesus' name I pray, amen.